With the election right around the corner and our ever-expanding network of podcasts, including our most recent edition, Scylla Consciousness, there's never been a better time to become a member. In addition to no ads, members receive bonus content for virtually all of our shows, an invitation to join the DSR Slack community, access to our Discord community, and enhanced show notes for select shows. Our goal is to make the DSR Network membership accessible to everyone, so for the month of May, enjoy 60% off the normal monthly or annual price for the first month or first year. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and enter code MAYDAY, one word, at checkout. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code MAYDAY. Thank you very much for your support.
Hi, this is Riley Fessler, producer for the DSR Network. Our episodes From the Archive and From the Silo this week are a two-part special from last year on why we have ended up where we are as a country. Here, in part one, David speaks with E.J. Dionne and Jennifer Rubin. We hope you enjoy.
Nine. 12. 10. 28, 2, 23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, as usual, David Rothkopf, coming to you from Cambridge, Massachusetts. We are joined today by two of the very, very best, most thoughtful columnists in the whole world, Jen Rubin and E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post. Welcome, both of you.
Good to be with you.
Thank you. I was going to say the same of you, David. And E.J.
Thank you. We should come on your air all the time. That's very sweet of you. Thank you.
Well, you should. But I'm going to do something that's a little unfair and a little difficult. I've just been, you know, every time I do a podcast, and I do a bunch every week, I go and immerse myself in newspapers and the Twitterverse. But this week, we were doing a tryout. We're about to launch, we think, with somebody else, a podcast aimed at the under 30 crowd, trying to get them more interested in foreign policy, public policy. And the question that we did in a little study group, that, you know, we said, you know, what would be appealing to this group? And almost everybody came back to one thing. That, you know, they came back to their friends asking the question, why are things like this? I mean, they put it in a variety of ways, right? They said, how did things get so fucked up? You know, and so on. But in each of their ways, that, you know, you have people entering the workforce, and Jen, you know, congratulations. We just heard you have a child who just graduated from college. We all do. We all have, you know, our kids out there. The first question when they look at the way Washington works or doesn't work and American politics works or doesn't work, to say nothing of the rest of the world, is how did we get here? And I'd like to talk about that a little bit. Jen, you did a column recently on, you know, Ron DeSantis and his commitment to ignorance. You know, that his big idea is, let's make Florida stupid, and then once we're done with that, let's see if we can do the same thing for the United States. How do you get there in 2023?
Well, obviously, there's no one simple answer, but I think there has been a gradual process by which one of the major parties has descended into right-wing populism, nationalism, if you will, even fascism. And this didn't all happen under Donald Trump's watch, but he certainly accelerated the process. And the decline of the party was in many ways promoted, enabled by some failures in the political system and even the economic system. One being really a general failure of the mainstream media to grasp the essential change in politics, that we were no longer dealing with two political parties operating within the democratic process, each advancing an agenda that intended to make life better for Americans. So that was one terrible failure. I think another was what has been called the Great Sort, that we have become so not polarized, I don't think that's the right word because that denotes an equal alienation, but separated from one another, that we now have a country in which it's possible for millions of people to live in these enclaves of red America and be rather ignorant about the world and be supportive of policies that, frankly, are harmful to themselves. You look at red America and you look at healthcare, you look at death from gun violence, you look at virtually any measure, and it's as if they're creating a third world country within America. And that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy and a really sort of inevitable downward spiral for many states, which is part of what I wrote about regarding Ron DeSantis. And I also think that we've come to a time where our citizenry has become passive, even lazy. You can fault the education system. You can fault a general sense of prosperity. When things are good and life is good, why do you need to brush up on the fine parts of policy or even turn out to vote? And I think all of these things are contributing factors. But I will come back to one essential issue that remains at the heart of all of this, and that is the original sin of America, which is race. And we have never grappled with this. When we get into difficulties, race becomes a pivot point, a dividing factor. And the more we ignore it and the more we allow voices of intolerance, of bigotry, of white nationalism to fester, the worse the problem becomes. I just returned from vacation, partially in the Netherlands, and it's always a fascinating experience, of course, traveling. You learn more about your own country. And throughout the Netherlands, you see a very concerted attempt in museums, in public debate, in the press to grapple with its colonial past. And although the Dutch take great pride in the golden age of the Netherlands and their great achievements, there is a real effort to wrestle with the fact that this was built on a colonial foundation which exploited and brutalized people. We've never done that here. And so when we get into these downward spirals and we allow people to reassort this noxious idea that America is defined by race and by religion, we find ourselves in real, real trouble. And I'm more optimistic now than I was a year or so ago, in part because I think President Biden has really done a remarkable job despite the press coverage. But this problem continues to fester. And the factors that, you know, accelerated the Republican decline into madness have not abated.
Yeah, that's a really, really thought-provoking set of comments. And clearly, one of the goals of DeSantis and the GOP now is not to learn about our past, in fact, to suppress it and to keep children from learning about it. Recently, for other reasons, I've been reading a lot about the history of the indigenous peoples who lived in this part of the world, and we're in complete denial about that, and that, in fact, we were a colonial power. We conquered other parts of the world and were extraordinarily brutal. EJ, you talk about this, and I know from knowing you that you grapple with it from a variety of different philosophical perspectives, including those associated with our sort of religious grounding in this country. You did an interesting column not too long ago about a conversation you had with Nancy Pelosi, contrasting her deep, deep religious convictions with her representing San Francisco, a place that is, you know, is sort of on the bleeding edge of progressivism in the United States. What's your answer to the question, why?
Well, first of all, on that Pelosi interview, it was really a fun and fascinating interview because she supports, first of all, she doesn't like the word tolerance because she thinks it's a negative word. And she insisted on openness, embrace, respect. And her whole view on these matters, on LGBTQ issues, on racial equality, on class equality, is that we're all God's children. And it all descends from there, or ascends, if I could, from there. And it was a really fascinating chat. I want to be, if I may, a bit more hopeful, perhaps, than Jen, partly because of where I'm sitting today. Right now, I'm in my office at Georgetown. I'm about this afternoon to be part of the graduation at the McCourt School of Public Policy here. And if you hang around a lot on college campuses, or have kids, I think, is another part of it, I think you get pretty hopeful about the long term. And that I always tell my kids that when their generation takes over, a much more diverse generation, by the way, than the one I'm part of, I'm really not worried about the country, and that when my generation is gone, I think we'll be better off. And the only problem with my theory is I want to be around to see it when it happens. And I do think that when you look at some of these divides, there is a really deep generational cleavage, sort of under 45 or under 40 and over 45, somewhere around there, maybe 50 now. It depends on where you want to put it. And I think we've gone through an enormous amount of social change in our country over the last 40 or 50 years. We've gone through large-scale demographic change. You know, one of my favorite stats is in 1970, only 4.6% of us were foreign-born. Now, 14% of us are foreign-born. It's just like we were around 1910. And guess what? There was a big backlash against that in the 20s. We passed really reactionary immigration legislation in the 20s. And it took until 1965, really, to reverse all of that. We've seen the backlash on race. I agree with Jen very much that we have been grappling with some success and then some setbacks on race. And I think of this in a way as a backlash against the second Reconstruction, that we had the Civil War, we had Reconstruction, Black Americans in the South were enfranchised. It was actually a great victory that was later presented in history as, oh, the corruption of Reconstruction. No, the South was democratized. And then there was a violent backlash by white elites and others that pushed back democracy, created Jim Crow. And it took us till the 64 Voting Rights, Civil Rights Act and the 65 Voting Rights Act to get out of it. And now I think we're going through something like that backlash that happened after the first Reconstruction. We got to struggle our way through that. But on your long question, I think that, you know, we could take hours talking about developments on the right that I think were unfortunately a steady march toward this radicalism. And I didn't fully see it. I saw some of it as it was going on. But whether you begin with Nixon's Southern strategy, move to Reagan beginning his campaign in Mississippi at the site where civil rights workers were killed, but it was more subtle then. And Reagan was never, you know, was not overtly racist. So he did use phrases like welfare queens, which sure carry a lot of baggage. Then you get to the Gingrich era, which was another kind of push toward radicalism. I want to shout out Matt Dalek's new book on the Birch Society, John Birch Society in the 50s and early 60s, where a lot of the ideas we're seeing now sort of come out of Birchism. And then you had the backlash against immigration. And I always like to say the Trump campaign in some ways began when Republicans in Congress killed George W. Bush's immigration reform. Where that was the signal of what was coming. And then, of course, you had the attacks on Obama rooted in lies about where he was born and is he a secret Muslim and all that. And that led to Trump. So I think we've gone through this progression on the right
that has led the Republican Party and the right wing to a very unfortunate place. And I am not a conservative, but there are brands of sort of Burkean conservatism that I respect. And, you know, I think conservatives are useful. Sometimes we progressives need to be called out or our ideas are impractical. There is a real role for conservatives in politics. But I think that there's not a role, it's mainly a destructive role when it's this sort of extremist radicalism. And I think it's just been a long path that the Republicans and the right have taken. I guess I wrote a book called Why the Right Went Wrong. So this is very much something that I really care about and think is very unfortunate for our country.
I would also say that this aspect of American society has floated around long before the Republican Party really kind of lost its marbles, whether it was the know-nothings, whether it was the 1920s, as you analogized, as you mentioned, regarding both a Red Scare and a fear of immigration. This lurks beneath the surface, and sometimes not even below the surface. And there are times where it catches fire, it ignites. I think, under the Obama administration, the vision of the first African American president so incensed these elements that they really kind of lost it, that this was the symbol of the changing demographics, the loss of white Christian Protestant control, and that although many of us just thought they were nuts and kind of off their rocker when it came to birtherism, that was really the primal sense for these people, where you see it's a through line all the way to Tucker Carlson to, Donald Trump, of this sort of raging hysteria about an America that they don't feel at home in, which really means that they don't control. I would also add that we have seen a horrible disintegration of the courts, a financial corruption and intellectual corruption that has done immense damage. And that while the Federalist Society was churning out people who had an ideology that on its face was somewhat plausible, the natural result of that was a change in the judicial structure such that many of these difficult, horrible developments are now being solidified by the federal judiciary. And that is a long-term problem. I have urged my Democratic friends to get much more serious about court reform, about filibuster reform, because that remains one of the most dangerous, I think, minority rule, anti-democratic, small d developments that makes all of this much, much worse.
Hey, everybody, some big news from the New Republic. TNR's Stop Trump Summit is making a stop in Philadelphia, the birthplace of American democracy. You know, that thing you cherish that Trump and the MAGA movement are determined to burn to the ground. The Stop Trump Summit focuses on how America got to this dangerous place, how Trump could use the government against its own people should he be reelected, and what laws and politics are at stake. The Stop Trump Summit will be held live at the Liberty View at Independence Visitor Center in Philadelphia on Saturday, May 18th from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Among the featured speakers are Mary Trump, Rick Wilson, co-founder of the Lincoln Project, Molly Jong Fast, host of the popular Fast Politics podcast, as well as Will Bunch, national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, David Cohen, professor at Drexel Klein School of Law, and PA State Senator Vincent Hughes, plus many others. It's an event you won't want to miss. It will be nothing if not cathartic, and it may even inspire you to action. For tickets, go to tnr.com/events. This threat to America's democracy and the future of our country must be stopped. Joining TNR at the Stop Trump Summit in Philly is a great place to start.
I think I'd be remiss if I didn't say this, because I think it's so important as part of this. We've had a long, slow decline in the fortunes of the middle class and working class in our country. It's Black, white, Latino. It began with a long growth of income inequality in the 80s, but then it was really accelerated by globalization, deindustrialization, the crash of 2008, 2009, which sent a lot of people into foreclosure. Lots of people in the country had to trade $30 an hour jobs for $10 an hour jobs. And it's a regional inequality that is really damaging to the country. Joe Biden carried about 450 counties. Donald Trump carried about 2,500. Joe Biden's counties represented 70% of our GDP, according to a study from Brookings. So while I do believe it's clear race and immigration and all of that are very much part of Trump's appeal, this has taken place in a context where there is a lot of anger out there. And I think, by the way, given the racial divisions, there's a real irony here, because William J. Wilson, the great sociologist, wrote about how deindustrialization was impoverishing the inner city as job opportunities dried up in the industrial economy. That's exactly what started happening in places, in industrial towns like the one I grew up in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Ohio. And it's so that people who are now on opposite sides of politics, in economic terms, a lot of them suffered from some of the same forces that we didn't redress. And I really like, I've always had a soft spot for Biden because I like Scranton Joe. And I don't know if he can pull it off or not, but I think one of the good things about Biden is he understands in his bones what has happened to a lot of people in this country, including people who voted against him and probably will vote against him again.
I think for that reason, EJ, one of the most critical things he is doing, he says it, and I think we don't completely grasp it, is he really is transforming the American economy by this influx of investment, both private and public, in tech, in infrastructure. And he is addressing, I think, exactly that deindustrialization, economic decline that you saw when you see chip plants, when you see huge infrastructure projects going into these places. That is the capacity, as he likes to put it, to grow the economy from the bottom up and the middle out. And if it works, it will be really a triumph of, frankly, economic industrial policy, which the conservative in me was doubtful about, to put it mildly. But nevertheless, you have to recognize success when you see it. And that, in turn, I think will have a political implication as well, as you say, EJ, because if people who don't go to college, or the substantial majority of Americans, see a pathway towards economic prosperity, success, stability, that will drain away a lot of this anger, a lot of this venom from the political demagogues who use it to gin up the country.
So I want to continue with this. It's fascinating discussion. I would point out on the last point, Jen, as somebody who came up in the Clinton administration, which was kind of Reagan light, you know, we were embracing a lot of the policies of the time. In retrospect, it's clear to me that these things got all muddled together. And the idea of leaving it to the markets, you know, which is really became economic Darwinism, may not have been more conservative. And I'll give you an example, and that is that in the 2008-2009 financial crisis, a couple of auto companies nearly went bankrupt, right? General Motors was one of them. But because we don't have social safety net in the United States, we had to bail out General Motors, lest a million people be put into the streets. In Sweden, Saab went bankrupt. Because they have a social safety net, they allowed Saab to go bankrupt. So which is the more conservative approach? Which one allows more to the markets? You have to recognize that the companies and markets exist to serve society. And when they stop serving society, that becomes a problem.
I think that's a brilliant point. Brilliant point. And I think you see it again when you travel. I know Republicans love to bang on Western Europe. But a country like the Netherlands has a higher per capita GDP, higher income. I think the per capita average there's about 57,000, much higher than the United States. Is that a more successful economic system or is it ours? There's trade-offs. We have this wealth-creating machine. We have an inequality-creating machine. We have an innovation-creating machine. But it comes at a huge cost. And the question is, do we really need all that incentive for wealth creation? I have maintained for a very long time, the rich and corporate America is vastly undertaxed, that we have made a hash out of our public spending. You only have to spend a couple of weeks on European trains to realize that, America is about a third world country when it comes to getting from one city to the next. But there are trade-offs. And I think Biden is a perfect example of the adage that if you want progressive gains, elect a moderate. And if you want to see capitalism flourish, elect a Democrat. And if you want to see the debt go down, probably elect a Democrat as well. So it's a fascinating experiment as we fear for our lives and for our democracy. But he's been remarkably successful. I know that's unpopular in the press, but it's extraordinary in some respects.
Well, it's in some respects, it's not an experiment because in the Netherlands and in Northern Europe, they've been doing this for a long time. And not only do they have a high per capita income, but nobody goes bankrupt from paying their medical bills.
Could I just say, David, I'm a social democrat at heart, and I think you basically defended the social democratic position very well, which is the market has its role, but the market can't dominate society. But I do want to shout out the bailout, the rescue of the auto industry. I've always thought it's ironic that in the end, one of the most popular policies that helped reelect Barack Obama was the closest thing to a socialist policy. Obviously, the government didn't take over General Motors, but everybody who criticized it said this is socialism. And that really saved the Midwestern economy because it wasn't just, as you suggested, GM that was going to go out. It was all the suppliers. It was a whole infrastructure of the economy that would have collapsed if we had not done GM and Chrysler. And we don't really think about that much anymore because it worked. We should think more about things that work.
Yeah, no, there's no question about that. I was really trying to get at the point. I once wrote a book. You know how you write books. They turn out like children, I think, in some respects, because one of them becomes your favorite and is often ignored by society. And I once wrote a book called Power Inc., which was about the relationship between corporations and governments. And you know, it begins in Sweden with the oldest corporation that is still in existence in the world. It was called for a long time Stora Kopparberg. It was a copper company. Now it's called Stora Enso and is a Swedish-Finnish company. But we forget that corporations were created by grants of the government to serve society and that charters and, incorporate, that they don't exist to serve purely the shareholders. They exist to serve social purposes. And that's something we've completely forgotten here. This is the point in our podcast where we typically take a little bit of a break and say to our listeners and the general public, isn't this a great discussion? Don't you want to hear the rest of it? And so you should become a member. Go to the dsrnetwork.com, click on membership. It's $5 a month. We have, as anybody who's following us knows, an expanding roster of podcasts, 9 or 10 a week, plus our daily podcast. And so being a member, you get a lot of value. So go to that, join us, and then you can hear the rest when I get into a really controversial dimension of this. For now, though, if you're in the general public, I say bye-bye. And if you're a member, I say stand by. So let me get to the controversial part of this. And EJ, I apologize in advance, but I know that Jen and I were just moments ago on Twitter looking at the same thing because I said something and she responded to it. But I want to talk a little bit about another taboo subject, which is the role of religion in all of this. The United States is way more religious than most of those European countries that you were visiting, despite all their history, or maybe because of all their history. But a lot of what is dysfunctional in the United States is associated with evangelical Christianity, churches that seem to be willing to embrace and endorse immorality in their leaders. And a lot of the hope comes from surprising places. Younger generation, which is in many respects less tied to some of these religious roots. And as Jen and I were just seeing, the most politically active group in the United States is atheists. And in fact, atheists will soon eclipse evangelical Christians in terms of their political donations and activity. And at some points in our history, including now in the eyes of some, people would go, oh my God, this is a disaster. We're losing our moorings. But when you look at some of these churches and the support they have for the Trumps and the DeSantises, you wonder if drifting away from them, moving away from them, actually can restore us to moorings of values. And let me start with you, EJ, because I know you grapple with this a lot, and then I'll go to Jen.
Yeah, well, you know what, you allow me my second Georgetown shout out, because the course I taught this semester and have taught now for several years is called Religion, Values, and the Future of Democracy. And so this is something that, like you, I've been pondering, like a lot of people have. I think the first thing is that the biggest thing that's happened on the religious front sociologically in the United States is the rise, not of atheists as such, although their numbers have ticked up, but what are called the nuns, which are people who have no religious affiliation. Some of them think of themselves as spiritual. A lot of them say they believe in God, but they have been utterly alienated from organized religion for a variety of reasons. This group is especially large among the under 30s. Among the under 30s, our friend Robbie Jones at PRRI, also Pew, you see up to 40% of the young people who are now religiously unaffiliated. I think that is in significant part a backlash against right-wing versions of Christianity, which have become sort of hegemonic in the political coverage. You hear a lot more about them than you hear, for example, about the Black Church, which has been in the vanguard of civil rights and social justice movements in our country. You hear a lot more about them than you hear about Reform Judaism, which has also been in the forefront of reform movements. The Catholic Church is split. Pope Francis is one of the most vocal advocates of the poor, of the environment. And what I think is going on in the long run is, I tell this to some of my very conservative friends, and some of them know it, like the late Mike Gerson, nothing has turned people off to religion more than the intolerance that you described within one part of the Christian church. The challenge, I think, is that while you're quite right that atheists have formed these a variety of forms of civil society, I think we lose a lot over the long run as religious institutions decline, because they can also be the source of strong forms of community, strong forms of mutual assistance, strong forms of help when people need a friend and support of a community. And I think we're going to struggle, as if the churches continue to decline, with how do we create forms of community that make up for their decline. But whenever this conversation comes up, I really want to remind people, for the last thing I'll say, there was a great piece in the Wall Street Journal by a writer called Jonathan Eig, who just wrote a new book on Martin Luther King Jr. And it was a piece arguing that he was a Christian radical, which is exactly what he was. And we forget how radical Christianity and Judaism have been in our history, and radicalism for good.
Yeah, you know, creating the beloved community that King spoke about. You know, I think what an adage that has held me in good stead in kind of understanding this is the politicization of religion isn't good for politics and it's not good for religion. When these churches became sort of cultural warriors and political activists beginning in the 1980s, I think they not only damaged our politics by skewing the central creed of America, which is that we're not based upon religion, but it also screwed up their own churches and their own faith communities. We need religion to be religious. We need religion to help develop a virtuous society, to tend to the poor, to tend to the sick and the needy, to welcome the stranger. And what they did in turning these into sort of MAGA clubs, if you can think of it, is turn what was a center of spiritualism and of moral stability into these pits of our friend Peter Weiner talks about this, of QAnon conspiracies and anti-vax, you know, sort of ideology. And that did great damage to those churches. And we see young people fleeing from them because they don't want to be you know, associated with these things. And we also see the noxious impact that they had as they have tried to impose this very particularized agenda on the rest of Americans. So I think, you know, although EJ no doubt differed with George W. Bush on many, many things, I suspect that his 1,000 points of light struck a chord with him, that we can have churches, religious organizations, civic organizations, what the conservatives love to talk about, these elements of civil society that are closer to people, that are more localized, they have a really important role to play. And they haven't been playing it for a long time because they turned themselves into red hat wearing MAGA activists. And that's bad for politics. And it's bad for religion. Perhaps there's going to be a course correction. Perhaps the marketplace of religious ideas will course correct and they'll say, you know, my God, we're losing all our young people. Right now, they seem to be simply doubling down and doubling down, trying to hold on to the people that they have. But eventually, they're going to run out of people.
My friend Melissa Rogers and I wrote a couple of reports on faith-based groups and government. Melissa now runs the faith-based office in the White House. If people want to look at those, they can find them at Brookings, because yes, I believe that these groups are so important. I just want to correct myself. I mentioned Christians and Jews. I should also mention the role of Muslims in America. Islamophobia is a dangerous thing in our country, and Muslim communities have provided also that kind of support. And American Muslims have been very important in supporting pluralism and democracy in our country. And I just did not want that omission to be a commission on my part.
Just very quickly, you know, King, who tried to create that beloved community, was not fond of the white mainstream Protestant movement that he wrote about very critically in the Birmingham letters. So they don't have a great track record when it comes to social justice.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And by the way, the same little study that Jen and I were reading before this notes that among the most active groups per capita are Hindus in the United States.
No, the Indian American community is really an important force in both sides politics, actually, right now.
Right, and all these things are shifting and changing, but I do think the discussion that we've just had touches upon some really core issues, which are not as often discussed or well understood, you know, it ranging from deep corruption in the institutions that are supposed to inculcate values in our society or preserve the values, ranging from churches to courts to political parties to the behavior of politicians the drift of some of those institutions away from issues like morality, ethics, and values, towards power and asserting their view. I think, in fact, it's quite possible that in 2024, the ultimate contest will be between those who argue that in the name of morality, they want to limit people's freedoms, and those who believe that the fundamental value in the United States is actually freedom to choose, whether it's a woman's autonomy over her body or the ability to pick up a book you want to read and read the book. In any event, I very much hope that both of you will return soon and we can continue this. And for everybody who is listening, no doubt you will want to follow both EJ and Jen at the Washington Post and on Twitter and everywhere else you can, because they're people who are doing great work illuminating these sort of shadowy areas of life in America. For now, thank you, EJ. Thank you, Jen. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And we'll be back with more discussions on this issue of why on tomorrow's podcast. So please join us for that as well. For now, bye-bye.